Welcome to the new season of the Internet Herald podcast. I'm your host, Zaid, and today we got...
What's up? And I'm Rish. We're back. We're back after a long hiatus. It's going to be an interesting season, Zaid.
It's been a brick, Rish. It's been a brick, and I'm happy to bring this series back and, you know, bring different, you know, unique perspectives on politics, philosophy, business, etc., onto the show, and we can, you know, we'll have agreements, disagreements, discussions, debates. It's really going to be exciting this season.
I'm looking forward to all the guests which are going to be coming on, especially since last season it was just us. So this season, you know, bringing guests, bringing some new faces, seeing what else is out there, I think that's going to make the show more interesting. Yeah, for sure. But what have you been up to, Zaid? How's everything going?
Been doing great, man. Just been trying to, you know, focus on myself. For people who don't know, I've been kind of doing dabbling in jiu-jitsu and, you know, the martial art. And, you know, I'm not by any stretch of the word like a black belt or blue belt, but it's definitely a fun, like, it's definitely challenging, and it's fun, man. It really is. And it's more of a thinking man's game than like, you know, people go in there with a wrestler mentality. You know, you see these wrestlers going against jiu-jitsu fighters, and then their first, you know, instinct is to get the guy down on his back, right? But the thing is, jiu-jitsu guys want to be on their back, and that's where they get like most of their, like, you know, they want to be on the ground, they want to learn how to escape, how to get different positions. You know, it's not just wrestling, okay, put the guy on his back and then 1, 2, 3 and then tap. It's more like you got to make the guy tap, and I think it's really fun. So that's what I've been up to. What about you, man?
Dude, yeah, I've been reading a lot. I've been obviously working, you know, working, school, internship, all that good stuff, and all that's been going pretty well. Yeah, but actually, so here's the thing. This is what I'll say: wrestling, superior art compared to jiu-jitsu, far superior. There's absolutely, like, dude, there is no argument.
Hold up. This is coming from a wrestler too.
How many UFC fighters, their base is wrestling? How many of them? How many champions have their base as wrestling? I mean, don't get me wrong, wrestling and jiu-jitsu are very close because they're both grappling arts, right?
Yeah.
And to be perfectly honest with you, the best art would basically be a combination of both wrestling and jiu-jitsu, right? You want the mentality of wrestling, right? You want the determination and the drive of which wrestlers have, and the ability to cut weight which wrestlers have, and like the sheer strength. Also, you want the technique on the back which jiu-jitsu has, right? Like, jiu-jitsu alone is good, but it's just like it's there's only so much you can do with it. Same with wrestling. Like, wrestling is great. I think you can do more with wrestling than with jiu-jitsu, because like we see that there's like applications of it, but you know, the ideal art is combining both, which is kind of what sambo is, right? Like, sambo is like the Russian, you know, I mean, obviously the Russians, they're like elite, right, in both wrestling and sambo. So I think like, probably if you're really thinking about like which is the more superior art, it's probably sambo. Because sambo is like, you see both wrestling and jiu-jitsu, and also you see striking sambo.
I don't know too much about sambo. Could you explain it a little bit more in greater?
So you know Khabib, right?
Like Khabib of course, yeah. Khabib Noor. Yeah.
Right. So Khabib, yes, he's a wrestler, but he's also a sambo artist. He's one of the best. He's a master of sambo. Like, in Russia, they give out titles like master or grandmaster or like world master or something like that. Yeah. So he's a master in sambo.
Is sambo essentially like a mix of, you know, like, for example, like ancient karate, at the place in the gym I work at, like I work out at, they kind of mix elements of judo, karate, jiu-jitsu. So is this kind of like a mix of like different martial arts kind of combined into one, or is it its own thing but similar to others?
So sambo, you'll see... you'll probably look at sambo and you'll see that they, you know, they are doing grappling on their back like jiu-jitsu. They're also grappling like wrestling, right? They're also striking. Yeah, and they wear a gi, I think, or something which at least looks similar to a gi, right? So yeah, so it's, in a sense, it's like many other martial arts, but it's also kind of, you know, it's doing its own thing at the same time. It's honestly the best way to compare it is like sambo is what MMA is, like a proto MMA, if that makes sense.
Okay, okay. Like for striking, I'm kind of curious. What do you think is more effective in MMA? Like, and this is up for debate. Some people will say that boxing is superior. Some people will say kickboxing. What's your take on that? Like, what do you think?
Muay Thai, bro.
Muay Thai.
I don't think there's like much of a competition, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, I know there is like the Burmese striking style, right? So if like Muay Thai is the art of six limbs, they're like the art of 10 limbs or something, because they use their head for striking as well. Which, I mean, I don't know how effective, like, I don't know how good that is as a fighter for you in the long run, right? If you're just using your head to strike, because that's like basically just asking for concussions. But Muay Thai is, I would say, like in the MMA scene, like that's the best striking art that I know of, right? I'm sure, you know, because like, hey, there could be other stuff out there, which I don't know about, because I don't come from a striking background. But from what I see, is that Muay Thai is what I see being as most effective, because it utilizes pretty much like, you know, some of your most, like it utilizes most of your body, right? And utilizes parts of your body which I think are better suited for striking, like your elbows and your knees, right? Like, yes, boxing, you're using your hands, but like, look at your hands, dude. Your hands have so many bones, right? There's so many moving parts. Like, I don't think your hands are really meant for striking. You know, there could be parts of your hands which you can kind of use, but like, there's more of a risk factor if you were to strike using your hands versus, say, your elbow or your knee.
Yeah, and I definitely think Muay Thai opens up like the different, you know, body parts you could use, like against, like you could use your elbows, you could use, you know, hands, feet, legs, thighs, whatever.
Your shin, dude.
Shins, yeah, shins, you know, shin. That's why you wear shin guards, man, to protect your shins, you know, because if you're, you know, continuously being, you know, kicked, it hurts, it adds up, you know, especially like right. One kick, one leg kick, then another leg kick, you're like, oh shit, this already hurts.
Right, exactly. You're slowly breaking your enemy down, right? Like, and this is the thing, like, this is what Sun Tzu talks about, right? And I thought about this, right? So Sun Tzu talks about how you should attack where your opponent is not defending, right? Where your opponent is weakest, right? So think about it, right? Like, if you're just, like, headhunting, right? Like, generally speaking, like, you can defend your head, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like, if you're quick,
yeah,
if
yeah.
You're trained, if you're real practice, right? You block with your arms, your heads.
But some people forget that fundamental, you know, defense of keeping your hands to your head. They get wild up that they want to like drop it down and, you know, get some punches in. But, you know, that just leaves your head like the most, like, you know, like the most vulnerable part of, you know, the thing that you got to defend, because you get hit in the head, you know, you're pretty much done. Like, you know, the head is pretty much where the brain is, and the brain tells you like how to, you know, communicate with the body. Yeah.
Right.
Not to get too scientific,
right. And because the people will try to protect their heads more, right, and protect most of their upper body. But like, if you look at, think about like you know, your calf kicks, right, your
shins, yeah.
Right, like that's just like that's a part of the body which is not like as well defended. You know what I mean? You can just kick at it nonstop and just slowly chip away, and your kick is your most powerful strike, right? It's like you're generating power from your most powerful muscles. This is the most powerful strike, right? So. You know, like Sun Tzu talks about is, you know, use your strongest strike, use your strongest attack on the opponent's, where the opponent's defense is weakest, right?
Yeah.
And if you're doing it persistently, of course, like that's going to take damage in the long run. Like, you know, look with Sun Tzu, right? Like, because his, like the art of war and stuff is kind of so broad, like you can apply it to many things, but, and sometimes you don't want to apply it to, you know, everything,
You could apply it to a lot of things in life. Like the book I was reading currently, and it's funny that you mentioned Sun Tzu, because I just finished a book called The Art of War for Small Businesses.
Right.
And, you know, even the author was a practitioner in jiu-jitsu. He even mentions that many of the, you know, concepts that Sun Tzu, preaches in his, like, in his literature applies very well to jiu-jitsu. Because think about it, you're going against, like, one opponent. That guy is your competition, essentially. And for when you apply that to small businesses, let's say you're new to a field and you're trying to establish a small business and you got these larger competitors, you kind of have to use those kind of teachings from the Art of War in order to, you know, because the whole point of the Art of War is to see, okay, it's not about so much military strength, rather it's about the leader's values, like the general's values, based off what I've read, his own values and the morality that, let's talk a little bit about morality, because that's one of the first key values that Tunzu talks about, right? Man. Talks about morality.
What I'll say is this. I think the art of war is winning. I think that's what the art of war is about. It's about winning. But you're right. They do talk about morality, right? It's like the first point they bring up.
Yeah.
Right? What I think, right? So here's the thing. Sun Tzu talks about a general must fight for a moral leader, right? Because he's a general, right? Because he wasn't a king. He was just a general, right? So he's saying a general must fight for a moral leader, right? And if a leader is moral, then the army has a higher chance of winning. But the thing is, like, the majority of the book is about deception. It's about information warfare. It's about spying. It's about, you know, just base treachery, right? Like, that's what it's about lying. It's about figuring out how to deceive your opponent, right? Like, that's not really, you know, like, if you might think about it, you're like, hey, is that really moral? So here's the thing, right? Moral systems are very contextual dependent, right? So, like, the morality system you have in, say, Saudi Arabia is going to be different from the morality system you have in Brazil, right?
Yeah.
And the idea is, when they say that the leader must be moral, is I think what he's really trying to say is that the leader must establish a moral system where the leader, right, he or she or whoever, is the most moral person, right? Like, they are always in the right. They are the righteous person. And in a war, they are the righteous side, right? So, you know, like, how do you do that? You do that with, say, propaganda, right? Like, each country thinks, generally speaking, when a country goes to war, or not just a country, but when people go to war, right? And it could be whether in business or whatever. Generally speaking, you know, the winning side, right? The side which ultimately ends up winning, or the stronger side, usually thinks that they're in the right. Heck, I mean, both sides could think that they're morally correct, that they're in the morally better situation compared to their opponent, because that's kind of what the good leader is feeding that to their public, right? It's saying, like, hey, we are the morally correct ones here, right? Like, there's a reason why George Bush was like, oh, Iran, they're part of the Axis Empire, they're the Axis of Evil Empire. Okay, now we're gonna go invade, right? Like, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, there's those little, yeah, good.
Yeah, sorry to cut you off, but there's a very interesting quote that I once read. I forgot who it's from, so I can't, you know, properly cite it. But it says, "One man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist, and vice versa." You know. So, yeah,
like, think about it. Like, who was, like, during the American Revolution, right? If you were, you know, the British Empire,
yeah,
right? If you're an English person, like, to you, these rebels, right? The George Washington, Jefferson, like, to us, they're heroes, obviously, right? Because, you know, hey, you're Americans. But for them, yeah,
they're seen as terrorists, essentially. Right? Yeah, they're
seeing
Boston, like,
Tea Party. They would have seen the Boston Tea Party, like, what is this? You know, why are you sabotaging your own country? You know.
Yeah, and in a way, like, also, I've seen this very prevalent recently in the Middle East, you know, Israel, Palestine, especially in the Gaza Strip. And you see, there on the Israeli side, there's this sense of unity, you know, in a sense. And also on the Palestinian side, in fact, I read an article saying that this is the first time in many years that, you know, Hamas and the Palestinian Authority were able to unite, you know, like, with their, you know, their beliefs when it came to Jerusalem. You know, which is very contested right now, and under a lot of international scrutiny. You know, and the thing is, you need to create that sense of unity. That way people can see, you know, your sense of morality in a way. Because, you know, if, let's say, for the Palestinian side, I'm of Palestinian descent, I do find myself that I can see where the Israelis are coming from, you know, maybe some of their point of views. But for me, I see myself, my blood is Palestinian. So those, I have to side with my people. And, you know, what Palestinians have said essentially is that, listen, we Palestinians cannot keep, like, stay divided. You can't have, okay, Gaza is, you know, one part of Palestine and West Bank, you know, and then, we, you know, that divides us in a way, because it says, oh, that's a Palestinian from Gaza. You know, I'm from the West Bank. Why do I relate to him? Rather than, oh, we're all Palestinians, we're all in this together, you know? So I think that's, you know, a sense of unity is definitely important as well. And that comes from morality too, like seeing, okay, do we have the same sense, perspective on morality? Or is our definition of morality and our interpretation completely different than even some people from our blood or our ethnicity, you know? So what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think morality can be used as a unifying force, right? Like, I mean, morality, culture, right? Because
It's one aspect. I'm not saying it's the, you know, morality creates unity in the end of the day. I think
it's an essential aspect in creating unity, right? Like if you're a group, right? If you're a team and you cannot agree on the same like ethical principles or same moral principles, right? And you're going to be entering a conflict where definitely there's going to be breaches of those moral principles. Like, how would you know when those moral principles are being breached, when they're not? Like if person A thinks that person B doing what he did was immoral, but then person C thinks they were completely okay, they're completely in the fine, that creates disunity, right? So morality for that reason is essential in creating unity, right? And like the good leader, a good leader will ensure that there is that sense of morality, right? Like a good leader will be able to adapt the moral system to be able to fit whatever situation they're in so that they're still in a morally righteous position, at least from their perspective, right? So it's not about like who's right or wrong, right? Because like it's up to anyone, you know, it's up to the people to judge ultimately, right? It's not about who's right or wrong. It's about, can the leader convince his group that they're in the right position, morally right position?
Yeah, and the thing is, it's based off their own interpretation of morality and how they can convey it to the rest of the
people. I mean, it's just a tool at that point, right?
It's not even
about what my interpretation of morality is. It's like, okay, how can I use this tool effectively so that people follow me, right? So that people are willing to go to war for me, right? And I think it's important to also like define kind of what like war is, right? So power... Right, and so power is basically the ability to restrict or expand someone's options, right? Violence is the use of force to restrict someone's options. War is when two violent forces, right? So two forces who are trying to restrict each other's options, when they conflict against, when they collide, when they conflict against each other, like that's war. So if say I'm a business and I'm trying to take market share in Houston, and another business comes along and they're also trying to take market share in Houston, right? And we're willing to undercut each other. So we're using the force of economics, basically, or the force of price to try to, you know, restrict each other from the market. Then at that point, we're at war, right? We're not physically fighting, but it's just that we're using force to restrict each other's options, right? So we're using violence against each other, basically. And these violent forces are conflicting, and therefore that's war, right?
Yeah, but when it comes to war, the thing is, what people get wrong is that two forces are going to be equally as powerful. There's always going to be one that has the upper hand, has maybe more allies. That's why I think it's crucial if you are going to determine war, like, you know, declare war, that you know who your allies are and know like what your strengths are. Yeah, and also, don't be open to deception. Like, remember like how you were talking about, oh, deception is one of the key factors when it comes to, you know, like the other side trying to make themselves look weaker. And that's not the case. And it is a powerful tool to, you know, show, oh, we're underutilized, our army's not as strong, you know, and then in actuality, they're like just is, you know, like not too far away from, you know, the force of power from the other side, you know? So, yeah.
I mean, deception could also be showing that your strength, right? Like, so one time, right, the United States, released a film of, and it was just a loop of five planes going across the sky, five fighter jets, right? And it was a loop. They released it, and you know, they purposely made sure that the film got to the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union ended up overspending on trying to catch up its air force to be larger than the United States. So the Soviet Union, basically what they did was they took, so what happens is when you take resources from one, when you take resources, a lot of resources, and put it into just one project, you're taking resources away from all the other projects, right? So the way the United States was able to weaken this, like a method of weakening the Soviet Union, right, was to over project their power, right? So they deceive not by showing that they're weak; they deceive by showing that they're so strong, and the Soviet Union was like, okay, we have to catch up to them, And in the process, suddenly all these other departments are suffering because, oh, well, now all the money has just gone to making these planes to compete against the planes of a country. But these planes, the planes of that country don't actually exist.
Yeah. But also, like, I think that's also very, like, you know, it, when it comes to war or conflict, essentially, like, some person, like, showing how much power they have, you know, like, for example, let me give you an example. During the jiu-jitsu tournament, I saw this really buff dude, like, really muscular, had, like, a lot of mass on him. We're the same way, but he had a little bit more muscle mass on him. And my coach just said, listen, Zayd, don't let that scare you, because that just goes to show that he tried to look more like a bodybuilder than actually a jiu-jitsu player. You know, because if you see actual really good black belts and blue belts, they're not the most, you know, built or jacked people. That's more of a bodybuilder kind of thing. So when I saw that guy, you know, even though it kind of intimidated me a bit because he had so much muscle mass on him. But, you know, at the same time, if the person who can, you know, the person who's trying to deceive and to show how strong, like how strong they are, in actuality may be the weaker side, you know? So, yeah. So,
also your coach could have deceived you into knowing whether he was actually strong or weak, right? Like your coach could have said that, right? Even like your coach could have known, for example, that, oh, this guy's actually very good. Let me go to Zay. Let me tell him that, he's just show. Right. Yes, deceiving you. But guess what? Now that's going to give you confidence that you're going to win. Right. If you were to go compete against that guy, you're competing with more. Rather than competing in fear, you're competing in confidence. Now you're going to have a higher probability of winning. So you kind of see like what I mean. Like the deception is not just about can you deceive your opponent. Like, in a sense, deception is a tool which you can use universally. Like you can use deception on your own men if it means that, hey, it's going to give you the results which you want. It's going to allow you to win, right? And like ultimately, like that's what the whole point of war is. Like you don't, like if you're entering war not to win, then you're going to lose. Like you don't understand what the point of war is. Like the point of war is to win.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No one's goal in life or any obstacle, like you don't go into a match, for example, thinking I'm going to lose. It's more right. Like I'm going to give my 100% and I want to win. And, you know, losing is not even on your mind, because if even if that thought of losing just pops up, like, you know, it could trick you and the whole winning mindset could, you know, be affected by that in a way.
Right.
So when I go into a jiu-jitsu tournament or something, I don't even look at I say to myself, I'm going to give my 110% and it'd be nice to win. I don't think about
losing. Really? You say it's nice. Dude, I used to always go every single time. I was like, I'm going to win. I'm going to, like, I could be going against the state champion and I was like, yeah, I'm going to win. This guy, he's nothing. I'm going to win. And in my mind, I'll be just drilling through them. And then, you know, obviously I'll compete. Sometimes I won, sometimes I lost. But for me, like at least like this is the type of person I'm, right? Like I cannot have that little voice at all in my head. If it's there, I need to kill it immediately. So I'm just like, I'm going to win no matter what.
Well, some people, again, you could argue this. You could say that some people who keep in mind that listen, like they humble themselves a little bit and they're like, they see themselves as humbling themselves.
Yeah.
And they're like not too stressed out about like winning itself, but saying, okay, what technique do I got to use to take an advantage? And again, that's all part of the winning mindset.
I mean, but you can think about what technique you're going to use, right? Like if you have the mentality of I'm going to win, right? So rather than it would be nice to win, if you have the mentality I'm going to win, that doesn't mean that you're going to ignore the fact that your opponent's skills, right?
Yeah, but
you're still going to drill them. You're still going to think about them.
Saying I'm going to win instead of how I'm going to win, I think that's the question.
But if you say that I'm going to win, right? If you're a good martial artist, you're also thinking about how I'm going to win, right? Like yeah. I think knowing how you're going to win gives you the confidence to be able to say I'm going to win.
Yeah, I definitely see that. Like, what's another thing from Tenzu's that he mentions? Like, what's another?
Dude, he mentioned so many things. Like, you have to understand, the art of war is just a pamphlet on how to win. Like, literally, it's a winning guide, right? And you know, there's so many just interesting things which you can apply to so many different places. For example, like the idea of being compact, right? Of you want all your resources, like you want all your men and resources, everything to be close together, right? You don't want, because it's easier to defend that than say something just stretched out, right? Or the idea of, you know, obviously that all warfare is information and all warfare is deception, right? Like, yes, of course it is. Like, it makes sense. If you think about, you know, things like resources, resource management, you know, time, considering factors which are beyond your control, right?
Like economics, you need to keep in mind the economic factor. It's not just so much the physical and military aspect of it. You also need to keep in mind, how am I going to take care of my soldiers? How am I going to unite them psychologically? How am I going to, you know, provide? Like, because the thing is, like, if you need to keep the soldiers on your side, you got to make sure that you're taking care of them, that you are, like, because they're looking at you as the leader. And if you're showing that, like, the leader is only very arrogant and selfish, and he only wants to win based off what his needs are, without taking care of his army, the army is slowly, you know, the army is going to, you know, his military is going to start to break up.
I mean, internally, the army, like, yes, there's that. But also, I feel like, at least in, like, a purely militaristic setting, I think discipline, like, just drilling your soldiers in discipline, right? Like, that's going to kind of prevent a lot of that. Because there's going to be moments where you're just going to have to be, like, a bit more selfish, right? You're going to have to be like, hey, I have to take this gamble, or I have to take this hit here for us to be able to achieve the conditions of victory, right?
Yeah, but there could also be, there's always that one soldier that's not always going to agree and may, like, see what the leader is doing.
Yeah, but that's where discipline comes in, right? If you have a soldier who doesn't agree, right? Like, you either try to figure out how to correct them, or you make an example out of them, right?
And how... Give me an example.
Do you know how, I think his name was Cassius. So have you heard the word decimation?
I don't know the definition of decimation, but
decimation means like to destroy, basically, right?
Okay, essentially
decimate, right? Decimate. Okay. So decimation comes from a Roman punishment, right? Basically, I don't know who exactly invented it, but I know that Cassius used it famously. And I think his name is Cassius. He was part of the triumvirate with Julius Caesar and Pompey. Okay. But basically, you go, if say your army loses a battle, right? And or especially if your army like ran away, you basically round the guys up, and you every 10th man. So it doesn't matter whether that guy was brave and a good fighter, and try to stick his ground, or whether that guy ran away. It doesn't matter. Every 10th man you pick out. So you count, so you line them up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you're coming with me. And the 9 guys before you, you guys have to take sticks and beat this guy to death. Go. And you do that throughout your entire army. Every 10th man is going to get beaten up by the 9th guys to death. That's where the word decimation comes from. So that would basically, if you were weak, if you're pathetic, if you did not listen to that general, right, you were not the only ones who were going to suffer. Everyone was going to suffer. And the reason they were able to get away with that is because the Roman army was just so disciplined, right? They were like the individual was crushed in the Roman system, at least the Roman military system. It was all about the collective. So yeah. Something like that was extremely effective, right?
Yeah, but also, and I see that also demonstrated in the U.S. military. Like, again, have you ever seen the movie Full Metal Jacket? I'm assuming you've heard of Full Metal Jacket.
No, I've heard of Full Metal Alchemist.
Okay. I can explain. Full Metal Jacket was a movie in 1987. It was focused on the Vietnam War. And there's this one scene, and with the generals just going through, like, you know, talking with his troops, yelling, you know, everyone's in like their position like this, standing like this. Yes, Sergeant. And like, you know, and he sees one guy, and the guy, you know, one of his soldiers, and he has a smile on his face. You know, you could obviously tell he's a goofy kind of guy. Right. And then he's like, "What's up with that stupid smile on your face?" He's like, "Give me 10. And then like he said, and then he keeps adding on the pushups. And I don't know exactly what, like, you know, like it's been a while since I've seen the movie, but he kind of makes throughout the first half of the movie, kind of makes an example out of that guy. There's even a scene in which the fat soldier has a donut hidden in like near his bed bunk. And like the soldier finds it, and he's like, "Everyone's going to start like scrubbing the floor with I don't know what it was, like toothbrushes, because this guy decided to, you know, sneak this donut in." And I was just like, okay. So that's what came to mind. Again, I could have gone the scene. It's been a while since I've seen the movie, so I don't know exactly what the punishment was.
What do you think of military movies or war movies?
Military movies? Well, it depends, because there's so many.
yeah, but like, so I was having a discussion earlier with someone, right? And they said they don't like war movies. They don't like military movies, right? And I'm like, why? It's like, because like the best ones are about how pointless war is, right? So they don't like it because they understand why, you know, they're making it, but at the same time, they don't want to continuously see that theme over and over again. So, but like, what do you think? Like, what's your opinion on military movies?
I think if they're done well, and you know, they're historically, again, it's not going to always be 100% historically correct. There's always going to have that Hollywood dramatic.
I mean, a military movie could just be like medieval shit, like random fantasy, just people are fighting, right? Like,
yeah, oh yeah, it could. It doesn't always have to necessarily be like based on a true story.
It's just a movie about war and the people who are involved in it, in like a, you know, a physical war. Like,
I think that it needs to be complex because war is complex in itself. It needs to explore different themes. It needs to develop its characters. It needs to make you feel, you know, and that's for every movie, to be honest with you. I'm kind of,
what particular themes, like there are some certain particular themes which like define certain genres, right?
I'll give you an example. Saving Private Ryan. Have you ever seen the movie Saving Private Ryan?
I've heard of it, but I haven't watched
it. There's a scene that is very, like, you know, they have one of the soldiers captured and the soldier's begging them, please don't kill me, please don't kill me. And these are the heroes that are literally pointing the gun at the soldier. And, you know, it leads, like, it gives the audience kind of like a reflection, like, okay, well, you know, these are supposed to be the good guys, but here's a soldier begging for his life, like, please don't kill me, please don't kill me. But we're supposed to be rooting for the guys that have the gun to his face. So that kind of explores in a complex theme in itself. Like, are these really the good guys after all? Are they really the moral ones? That's an example of, you know, if it was to bring up more difficult questions rather than, oh, the army is the good guys and the Taliban or, you know, whatever they're going against is the bad guys, then there's no complexity to it. I feel like, you know, you also have to establish your characters, you know, make you feel for the army or the military as well. Even if it's like a Lord of the Rings movie, you know, like when they had the fight scenes and stuff, you generally care for the main, you know, the main characters because they throughout the movie, they develop it. And, you know, the Lord of the Rings movies are pretty freaking long. They're like 3 hours or so.
The epic suit, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, Peter Jackson's an amazing director and he was able to, you know, you care for Frodo and all these characters, you know, and then when they're in peril and, you know, by all these creatures and different forces they have to fight. You know, you know their personality and you know what they stand for and who they are. That's why I like Saving Private Ryan. It does, and it brings such a human aspect out of the military because so often we see on the news that the military, you know, they're either in war or, you know, defending our nation, but you don't really get to see a more complex view of like their families, what they stand for as individuals, you know, their personality, et cetera, et cetera. So I feel like a good military movie will focus on character development. It'll focus on, you know, more complex themes. You know, not just black and white, good guy, bad guy, but it will get, you know, the audience to question themselves in a way, to get them to think, because I think that's just in any movie that really raises difficult questions is a movie that is, you know, above the rest in a way.
So for a movie to be good. And this is regardless of what genre it is. Do you think it has to raise those difficult questions? Like, could a movie be good, like to be like exceptionally good without ever like asking difficult questions to its audience?
Well, I think we need to ask ourselves difficult questions because if everything is just kind of straightforward and handed down to us and, you know, fed to us.
I mean, you know. Yeah, but I'm talking about like, can a movie be good if it's not like.
It can, would it you can.
So. For an exceptional movie, for a movie to be exceptional, like you would think like, okay, this is one of the greatest movies of all time. Does it need to ask this difficult questions or can it just be like, you know, just a life or just, you know, a movie about a bus driver, you know, driving through the countryside of Japan, for example?
Well, in itself, it does bring up some sort of, you know, complexity in a way. I don't like films that are very straightforward and handed down, like in a way like, yeah. Or cliche. Like for me, you ask me, oh, what makes a good military movie? Those are my two, you know, main values, like, right. You know, character development and also, of course, production value, direction, production, all that together it like contribute to the quality of the movie. But for me, I want to care about the military. I want to care about the leader. And I also, at the same time, want to be challenged as an audience member. I don't want to just believe that these are the good guys, you know, and end of story and Taliban are bad guys. And I feel like, you know, movies are improving in that way, that they're giving a more perspective of the other side as well. You know, like nowadays you'll see, like if there's a movie about a war in the Middle East, you'll see the perspective of the civilians and, you know, that maybe the Americans aren't doing the best for that country. And maybe there's more, maybe the good guys that we're cheering on for throughout the movie, maybe what they're doing is not even in the best interest of morality. So,
I mean, well, then again, right.
Context. But then but then the universal, there's a universal morality in a way. Like, we know that killing people is bad.
Like, sure, but like, would you, if you were to go back, this is why I say contextual, right? If you were to say, go back to, you know, the Aztec Empire or the Mayan Empire, like they were performing human sacrifice, or not the Mayan Empire, the Mayan civilization, right? And the Aztec Empire, like they were performing human sacrifices. To them, like that was essential. It wasn't like, oh, it's just, no, it's not just that it's good, it's essential, you need to do it. So that's what I mean. Like, you, if there is such thing as a universal morality, it needs to apply across all contexts, no matter what, like the, whatever the principles of it are. I mean, maybe there is. It's just like, I don't know, you know, what those universal principles will be.
Well, you did, you one time me and you were talking, and then you're like, I'm like, oh, morality could have so many interpretations. Like, how do you know what is the universal morality? But I think that kind of has to do with also religion and culture as well. I think that also contributes to what people perceive
right,
as their kind of morality. Like, a Muslim's morality is a little bit different than, let's say, Jews or Christians, for example. Even though we're all people of the book, there are different, different teachings.
Different systems.
Different systems, different teachings, yeah.
Right, yeah, fair.
But also,
like, just real quick, right? Have you seen the movie which called it's called Mr. Hello, I think, or Mr. Happy?
Mr. Happy? Who's in it?
It's a Japanese film. And
I probably wouldn't have seen it.
Gotcha. It's literally a movie about a bus driver who drives from one end of the country, like who's driving from the countryside to the city, right? Like, and like the passenger they pick up along the way and so on and so forth.
Let me search it up.
Very, like...
What's it called, Mr. Happy?
It's either Mr. Happy or Mr. Hello. Something like that.
It's not Mr. Happy. I'm curious myself, like, what the film is about.
Yeah, I think you can find it for free on YouTube. It's very interesting.
Like, I'll search it up later. It's okay.
It's very relaxing.
Explain the plot of the movie, because this
does It's just seem... literally a bus drive. It's a guy who's driving a bus filled with passengers, and, like, you see the stories of those passengers, kind of, you know, how they interact with each other on the bus, and sometimes, you know, they kind of share parts of their stories. For example, there's this one of the main passengers who gets on the bus, you know, at the very beginning of the movie, right? It's this lady, this very young girl who comes from, like, a poor family, and she's going to the city. And, you know, before they get on the bus, this old lady asks her, "Oh, are you gonna be, you know, cleaning or, you know, doing the dishes and stuff like that in the city, right? Like a cleaning job." Mm-hmm. And like her mother kind of just starts crying, like the girl's mother just starts crying, and she's like, "Oh." Like, you know, I'm sorry. Like, you know, you're such a young girl. Like, it's sad that this is happening to you, right? Which is basically, like, you know, basically what's happening is that poor family is taking their, you know, little daughter on this bus to Tokyo or to whichever city they're going to, and they're basically going to sell her into prostitution.
Yeah, but doesn't that bring up, difficult questions in itself?
That is... Yeah, in a sense, they're difficult, but the way the film tackles those difficult questions, I think, like, I don't think, like, they dive super deep into it.
It needs to be dived into.
Yeah, right. It's more like, you know, kind of just like, yes, it's there, and it's like the struggles of the bus driver who kind of knows about what's going on, and like how he's kind of contemplating, like, what can I do to, like, maybe stop this, or like if I should take any action. Or inaction is better, you know what I mean? So there's still, like, difficult... I guess there's still questions being asked. But I don't think they're, like... You know, I don't think those questions need to be so...
It's more subtle. You're saying it's more subtle. It's not... They don't delve deep into the complexity.
I think it's more realistic. You know? I think if you're in the situation that these characters are in, the questions... For example, like, the question of should I take an action or should I not take action? Like, is this my business to be involved in? You know?
Yeah, I got you.
I feel like that's more of a realistic question than, like, a more deeper question. Like you were talking about, like, right? Like, which side is, you know, are the heroes really the heroes, right? Like, that, I think that's more of a more complex situation. So what I'm saying is, like, a movie can be great even if it asks questions, but, like, you know, in a more realistic way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm not saying it has to be over the top or anything like that. Right. But there's also another film I wanted to mention. Again, this is now, like, branching on to films, but it's one that I would do one of. It's a Japanese film as well. It's very well known. It's also known as one of the most disturbing, actually, movies of all time. It's called Audition. Now, Audition, yeah. I think it does bring a complexity in a way. So it's basically about, in the beginning of the film, you see this child's mother, she passes away. And the father comes to his school, and essentially he has to bring the bad news that the mother has passed away. The film then fast forwards like 20 years or so. The dad is grown up, the son is grown up, the son has a girlfriend. Right. And the dad is feeling alone because, you know, he's for so long, he hasn't had a woman in his life. So his friend, who's a film producer, you know, he's like, oh, let's start this gig in which we bring these girls and pretend like they're auditioning for a movie role. And, you know, we'll find the right girl through there for you.
Dude.
I know it sounds like a terrible idea, but...
I mean, don't even like I know Japanese movies, they explore some interesting ideas.
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting theme because you start to question yourself. Okay, this is kind of a deceiving way of trying to get a girl.
Oh,
to...
no, it's as like it's disgusting. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's like hey, there's no movie. Like, you know what? Like you don't see movies on that, right? You don't see literature on that as at least as often. So when you're exposed, especially if it's well made, like it's like, huh. So that's like it like sometimes, you know what I mean? Like sometimes you have to explore the perspective. You have to explore what a monster is, I think. Or you have to explore like things which you may perceive as negative, right?
Yeah, but here we have the main character doing a very deceiving thing, you know?
Right.
And, you know, but at the same time, you feel bad for him because, you know, his wife passed away 20 years, but that doesn't make what he's doing is right.
Yeah, it doesn't justify his actions. But you still want to, like, you want to know, like, why.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
You want to know what's motivating him, really.
Yeah, and the movie has
like,
a lot
of... captivating.
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of twists and turns in the movie. I don't want to spoil it, especially for people who haven't seen it, because it does turn out the girl he does find... There's something up with her. There's definitely something up with her. And it just goes to show that maybe an immoral action... that at first may seem like, oh, I got like a benefit out of it, may not so in the long term might not be so, you know. And the reason why I bring up that film is because we're talking about, you know, films that raise difficult questions and main characters that maybe may not always be in the right and may not do the right things, but even though they have good intentions. So I do like the film that it did bring that, like the main character is doing a deceiving thing and like something that, you know, is looked down in our society, you know, rather than going to talk to a girl, you're pretending like she's going to get a movie role, you know? So, and it's one of my favorite films that I think is very well done. And if anyone hasn't seen it, I highly recommend it. You know, I do feel like international films in a way kind of stray away from the whole black and white perspective. Not to say old American films follow that perspective, but, you know, when you delve into maybe there are more colors than just black and white when it comes to characters and, you know, their intentions and whatnot, like,
no,
rather
than
your
favorite film.
That's hard, man. That's really hard. I could give you maybe a top five list. I could probably give you a top.
What's your top five?
Our top three.
What's your top three?
I would say A Clockwork Orange by Stanley Kubrick. That's my first number one favorite movie. I don't know if you've seen these movies or not. I would say you would have to. There's a film called, I mean, I have to have the Godfather on there. Like, that's one of my favorite. Francis Ford Coppola and Apocalypse Now, another Francis Ford Coppola movie. And Apocalypse Now, that's a good military movie. If you haven't seen that, it's very long, though.
I'll definitely check it out, yeah.
There's an extended cut, which pretty much has the extended cut, the director's cut. Because the story behind that film is very interesting, that they were stuck in the Philippines or... it could have been another country. I believe it was the Philippines for a few months, and they were starting to run money out of the production costs. And the director, Francis Ford Coppola, had to mortgage his house to pay for the rest of the film. And, you know, some of the production crew and stuff, they were stuck in the Philippines, like in the middle of freaking nowhere. And Al Pacino was considered for the main character role. But he said, I'm not going to be stuck in the Philippines for 3 months. I'd much rather take another movie in America, you know? because he knew like the hardships that would come from filming in the Philippines, where it's super hot, long working hours, not the best condition to be in. You know, it's not like they were staying at the Marriott or anything like that, you know. Mm-hmm. And they finished the film, and you know, like Francis Ford Coppola really dedicated those few years. The film was supposed to be released in 1976, but it took until 1979 for the film to actually be released, because it took so much time, like so much of the production costs and everything were starting to be held back. So Francis Ford Coppola kind of had to, you know, with mortgaging his house and whatnot, had to kind of bring it back to.
He able to pay his house back?
I mean, he had.
I hope he did it with his house.
Yeah, he did. No, of course, man. He had plenty of other hit films after that, like Outsiders, Rumblefish.
Oh, you directed Outsiders? Dude, I love Outsiders.
Outsiders. The book is really good too.
Yeah, it is. It is.
It's very sad.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'll say for me, I'll give you my favorite. My favorite film. It's a tie. It's between two films. One is called Jalsagar. It's a Bengali movie which I saw not too long ago. It basically means The Music Room. It's classic, absolutely amazing film. The other one, it's a more modern film. It's on Netflix. I think you can find it. Called The Beast of No Nation.
Oh,
with
Idris Elba.
Yeah, dude, Beast of No Nation is epic, very epic. It's like
I haven't seen it. I've heard great things.
It's about child soldiers. It's about child soldiers, and it's very good.
And the general's played by Idris Elba, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so. I'll be honest with you, bro. I don't know the actor's name.
It's all good. Yeah,
but it's a fantastic film. I love it. And so The Music Room. The Music Room is like about. The Music Room is just honestly, it's an experience. Like it's an auditory and primary and auditory, but also visual. Like it's an experience overall. It's a package. It's really poetry as film. Honestly, it's amazing. Love it.
I think also how the film is made and like the different camera, you know, the cinematography, the music, just the direction itself, everything in the acting, especially. I think acting is one of the most crucial roles because you're watching actors essentially playing characters.
Right.
If you don't 100% buy the fact that they're playing the characters they're playing, I see this a lot in American films. I'm not quite buying like some of the actors.
Really? Dude, I think American films are good acting, bro. Like generally, like the, you know, the classic films and like the greats,
the classic films and greats. Yeah, but nowadays
I mean even
some of the Netflix stuff I've been watching, you know, I've seen, again, I'm not an actor, but I don't completely like it's more mediocre acting compared. It's not really bringing out the emotions or bringing out the characters as much from what I've seen, you know. And this applies
it's
to
not
TV
a Tetsuo. It's not a Tetsuo.
It's not
we watched Tetsuo. The movie Tetsuo Iron Man is basically what it means. Last night, dude. If you're gonna watch that film, I mean, honestly, it's pretty gory.
Let me explain to people who don't know. Tetsuo the Iron Man is a kind of a sci-fi horror movie from 1989.
Sci-fi? Is it sci-fi? It's like.
Come on, man. The guy's turning into
like
metal.
Japanese cyberpunk. I think no. Is it Japanese cyberpunk? No. It's like
Wait, hold up. I'm gonna
look at what, I know it's a very distinguished genre. Like it's like a.
Just give me a sec.
It's like industrial surrealism, man. But I know it belongs to a specific genre.
Yeah. It's Japanese. I was right about 1989, and apparently it's a part of a film series too. There's more than one of them.
Japanese what? Japanese.
Cyberpunk. I bet it's. Let me see.
Cyberpunk,
because that's a genre of super gory Japanese films. Yeah, it's a Japanese cyberpunk body horror movie film. Yeah, dude.
What a film, dude.
Some it's of these wild. Japanese movies are freaking gory.
They're amazing, dude. Yeah, House is epic. House is just surreal. It's just so. And so is this movie. Both movies are both very surreal.
Do you think it would have been as good if it was made in the United States, though?
If it was made exactly like the way, like if the techniques were exactly the same.
But I don't think in America we would have done, like, I think it would have been too controversial in a way.
I don't know what the context around the movie was when it was released. I assume it was probably very controversial in Japan as well. I mean, it should have been at least.
Because we have ratings here. We have, you know, G, PG, PG-13, R. This was entering like almost NC-17 territory, bro. I don't think it would have made. And also, like in America, we're more focused on, you know, how much money is the film going to make, you know, because it's a business, essentially. This seemed more like an art film in a way. Like, not so much meant for the profit.
Right? I think it was a student project.
It was a student project?
Yeah.
It was a very well done student project. Imagine, the special effects were really
being a student. Imagine being a student and you make a film like that as a student. It's like, what?
Yeah,
like, that's one way to announce yourself to the world, I guess.
Well, some of these student filmmakers are talented, man. The original Evil Dead, 1981, yeah. Directed by Sam Raimi. He directed the Spider-Man movies after that film.
Word?
Yeah, that was a student film. And if you see The Evil Dead, it's not a PG-13 or PG movie at all. Like, it's very gory. I think the original initial release was rated NC-17.
Interesting.
Yeah, man. What do you think of the new Netflix films and stuff and the TV shows and all these new streaming?
I mean, they're all right. It depends. Like, honestly, I like what I really like right now, what's going on when it comes to the, you know, the like all the streaming platforms, is the content they're producing, in, you know, the non-English content they're producing, honestly. Like, there's some like original, so like, for example, India, right? Like, India is a fuck, it's a gold mine for when it comes, if you're a lover of films or like content, you would love India, right? Because like, there's so many languages and each language has their own film industry, right? In India, the census is like over 1,000 languages, right? And dialects. So yeah, there's a lot of different film industries, right? All at the same time, influencing each other and stuff like that, right? So because of that, like the stuff which is like, there's always been very talented filmmakers who just couldn't break into the mainstream, right? Because generally speaking, the mainstream of India is Hindi movies, right? Or sometimes like your English movies or your Tamil movies.
Bollywood. Are they all considered Bollywood, or is it Bollywood specifically Hindi movies?
So Bollywood, just Hindi movies.
Okay.
Yeah, Hindi film industry. Everything else is like their own film industry, right? So the thing was, there was a lot of talented people whose stories either were being blocked by the censor board, right? So the censor board basically censors things which they don't think the public should see. So like, you know, they would be like, hey, there's nudity in your film. You know, that film cannot be released. There's nudity. There's too much gore, etc., right? But because, and the censor board is only concerned about public releases in theaters, right? They don't care if you release it on a TV channel or whatever, right? The great thing about these streaming platforms is now those movies and those projects which needed to go through the censor board because their method of distribution was through theaters, now they're just like, hey, we're just going to put it on a streaming service, right? Like, we don't have to go through that board. And because of that, like, the content from India is just exploding and it's amazing. And it's, you know, you're seeing guys from every, you know, these industries, these language, you know, film industries, which come from languages which don't really have much of a market. Now suddenly they have access to the bigger market of, you know, not just India, but really internationally. And India is just one example. Like, you know, I think I saw like a Turkish movie, or not movie, but Turkish series. Not recently. Like
a Turkish, film. Yeah, they have a lot of good series. Like, a lot of the Middle Eastern countries and especially Arabic countries, they love Turkish soap operas. Like, my grandparents, there's a new one that my parents have actually been watching. It's called Ertugrul. No, it wasn't Ataturk. I think it's Ertugrul or something like that. Yeah, that's what it is. And it's essentially like the Turkish version of Game of Thrones set during the Ottoman Empire. And it's on Netflix. Now, a lot of Muslims are like loving it, and Arabs are loving it because it brings us in a light that the Western media hasn't seen us in. Like, as the warriors, as the good guys fighting against, you know, the Crusaders, which were, you know, we see as an oppressive force in a way, you know, how they came into Jerusalem and slaughtered Muslims and Christians. You know, so I feel like in that way, Netflix gave us an opportunity to, you know, like, show that Muslims can be warriors as well, too. And that maybe we have our own Game of Thrones in a way. So I do like Netflix productions when, you know, especially the international ones. But I also think a lot of them are cliche and a little, not so much a cliche, but maybe like half-assed in a way.
More marketable.
More marketable, yeah, exactly. Like, I don't feel like the quality of some of their production is as good as maybe some of the more international ones.
I mean, but that goes, but that, the thing is, like, the international things you're talking about are like the best, the cream of the crop of the international stuff, right? Like, every film we've mentioned, international film, is considered a great, like, some of the greatest works from those countries. Right, I think, like, generally speaking, like, most films, just like most works in general across the board in any field, like, are probably going to be mediocre, right? Like, for something to be the best, it needs to be you know, it needs to surpass something else. And once that thing has been surpassed enough times, it becomes mediocre. Like, I'm sure, like, when the films were first came out, the fact that they were just moving pictures already made them, like, amazing. You know what I mean?
What determines if a film is mediocre? Is it by the film, like, the critical reception received from
the film? I think it depends on
the individual. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Right? Because you can go on Rotten Tomatoes and you'll see, like, your favorite film has 44%, even though you in particular love that film. Right, and exactly. That's probably from a production standpoint, acting standpoint. You know, the critics really delve into like the actual quality of the film, rather if they enjoyed it, if it was entertaining.
I mean, it depends on the person, right?
Like, yeah.
I think everyone is a critic. I think, and I think that's a good thing.
Right? So
art should be individualistic.
If everyone's a critic, then like, where do we set the line in which what critics we listen to?
Your choice.
Yeah, because professional film critics generally agree with one another. Like the majority agree. There might be a minority that may, you know, assume a rotten film on Rotten Tomatoes is a fresh film, and you do see a couple of those. But the majority of professional film critics, that's how it contributes to the Rotten Tomatoes scores, by, you know, what does the majority think? What's their reception based off of it? You know, and it determines if it's a good film or bad film just based off of that. You know, and films are meant to entertain. People forget, like, you know, it's about entertainment value, but also you want to get quality out of your entertainment as well. So,
right. Yeah.
Yeah, man. What else besides films, like, do you do like hobbies or anything like that?
Dude, that's such a dry way of asking that question, dude.
Bro. Okay. We'll cut that.
Come
out.
On. I'm more interested in that. Honestly. Oh, dude, I've been doing a few things these days, you know. Like, I the thing is, like, recently, like, I've just been more busy with just like working with school and internship, right, and working on my projects, right, and businesses. So that's pretty much preoccupied most of my time. The only like hobbies which I have been able to make time for is like reading, right, and like aquascaping, because like, well, I have to keep my fishes alive, right?
And what do you like to read?
Dude, just anything, honestly. But my like right now I'm reading The Art of War, right? I'm reading The Epic of Gilgamesh. So I'm in a few reading groups, and that's kind of how I'm able to like keep track of what to read, or like, I guess, be able to like be held accountable for what to read, right?
Yeah.
It's Epic of Gilgamesh, and I'm reading this thing called the Chanakya Niti, which is a political, geopolitical slash, like, you know, like statecraft book, which was written by a man named Chanakya. He's basically the brains behind the Mauryan Empire, and the reason why the Mauryan Empire and the Mauryan dynasty was able to, you know, replace the Nanda dynasty before it established the Mauryan Empire. Which became like the first, you know, almost completely unifying force in South Asia. And like, since the Mauryan Empire, I don't think like there's never been an empire which has been able to unify as much of South Asia as the Mauryans did. And the Chanakya Niti, you know, Chanakya, the guy who wrote it, is like one of the biggest. He basically set the foundation for the empire and for that dynasty. And it's very interesting, because being able to read the Chanakya Niti and the Art of War at the same time, like, I feel like it's like enhancing the experience of both. Just because they're both written as...
Did they build off
instruction? Oh, they were written at different times, right?
Okay.
Right, and obviously they're very ancient texts, right? But the reason why it's great is because, like, they're both written as instruction manuals to their respective rulers, right? So, like, Sun Tzu wrote The Art of War because, you know, he was kind of, like, trying to explain how to win war to, like, you know, a leader, basically, one of the rulers in China during the Warring State period. And Chanakya wrote the Chanakya Niti because he was trying to leave a guide for future Mauryan kings after Chandragupta Maurya I to basically, you know, even when he passes, have his teachings and have his principles so the empire keeps going. And it did. It was pretty successful. And, you know, you get Ashoka the Great, like, right, like one of the most influential individuals in the history of humanity, really, like, and probably the biggest reason why Buddhism is as big as it is today. And, you know, it comes from, you know, a lot of that Ashoka and like the Chandragupta Mauryas and all those guys came in the middle and after, right? The Mauryan Empire. And even after a lot of the other Indian empires which came afterwards and a lot of these Indian states were heavily influenced by the Chanakya Niti, right? And yeah. The reason the Chanakya Niti, I think, why I think it has like really, it really rises to the top of when it comes to, you know, in the genre of state books about statecraft and leadership, is because, you know, India, the subcontinent, is extremely diverse, right? There's a lot of different ethnicities, a lot of different nations, and being able to unite those nations under one banner is extremely impressive. And the fact that the modern state of India even exists is a miracle in itself, because it has 1 billion people and all of those people are like different ethnicities.
It's like a continent. It's essentially a continent. It's not a country.
It's like taking all of Europe and saying, okay, you're now one country, right? Like, yeah. I mean, the fact that UK left the European Union recently, you know what I mean? Like, it shows just how hard that is, right? Or imagine if you said, like, okay, all of Africa, now you're one country. Like, hey, that's there's a reason why the conflicts we see in African nations occurs, because, you know, uniting people of different nations, of different ethnicities, different beliefs, different backgrounds together under one system is extremely difficult.
Well, I think also, you know, division itself can also be very difficult as well, because the Middle East used to be under, you know, the Ottoman Empire, the Muslim Empire.
Even during those era, I think like there was quite a lot of division, dude. Like, look, what was the most united point in the Middle East history, right? It was probably the Umayyads and the Abbasids. The Abbasids probably more so, right? But even within them, like the individual lords, right? The individual lords within each, like, you know, each jurisdiction, you know, each like individual, I guess, like jurisdiction within the Abbasid Caliphate, like throughout, like they had plenty of power, and you know, there were rebellions. There were, you know, the Caliph of the Abbasid Caliphate was basically, you know, many times just a puppet, right? And same goes for the Umayyads, because there were so many more other, you know, powerful, cunning, intelligent, talented individuals all around them, who were able to basically manipulate them, right? So and this caused a lot of divisions throughout their empire, right? So like. Even at that point, right, and it goes throughout history. Like throughout history, all empires are like this. Like big states who are ruling multiple ethnicities, multiple nations, basically struggle, right?
Yeah.
And things like the Art of War, things like Chanakya Niti, like these guides who have stood the test of time because they were applied by people who were in those situations, right, where they were in those difficult situations. Like it's. They're valuable today because then, you know, we're able to see, okay, what lessons did they learn? What are their teachings, right? Because rather than, you know, it's a lot easier to be able to walk on their path than to try to cut your own path out, right?
Yeah.
And then you can innovate on top of that.
Yeah. And I definitely do see where you came from, like when you were mentioning that, like, oh, there was some division that was going on, especially in the Ottoman Empire. I was even talking with some, you know, like a guy the other day, he said, oh, I'm from Lebanese descent. I'm like, oh, when did your parents immigrate? He's like, oh no, my grandparents or great grandparents. Like, oh, that's pretty. You've been here, like, that means you've been here for a couple generations. What caused you guys to immigrate? And then he's like, oh, the Ottoman Empire used to, you know, impose taxes on, you know, Lebanese Christians, Syrian Christians. Back then, it wasn't Syria and Lebanon, but, you know, Arab Christians,
right.
And that caused them to immigrate as well. So that there was some division, definitely. And you know, you need to keep in mind that the Middle East is very diverse area. There's the Kurds, the Turks, the Israelis, the Palestinians, you know, the Arabs, you know.
Right. It's many different ethnicities merged together, right? Like, it's so difficult to unite them. I mean, and that goes for every place on Earth, really.
Yeah, right? But could unification in itself also be a burden as well? Like, because, you know, or just trying to unite, you know, like, let's say, like, hypothetically, the Muslim or the Ottoman Empire or the Muslim Empire were to reconquer all that territory, it would be pretty problematic. And that's why the Soviet Union, you keep in mind that that's why the Soviet Union, one of the reasons why the Soviet Union collapsed was it couldn't hold on to that much territory and keep that control within, because the Soviet Union was pretty large, you know?
I don't know, man. Like, I've heard the territorial argument before that if a country gets too big, it's too hard to control. Fine, but like the thing is, we're at a point in technology where, and especially like by the 1950s, right? Like technology was good enough where you could control large swaths of land. I mean, look, the United States is one of the biggest countries on the planet. Alaska is like 4 times the size of Texas, and it's like its own thing, like, you know, far away from the rest of the country, right? And also, like, you know, then within the United States, right, you have places like California, which are just, like, so different from places like, I don't know, like Georgia or whatever, right? Like,
well, you could argue that the economic opportunities in each state varies, and that, like, some of the, maybe like Alaska economically, you could argue is not doing too well. Like, but
dude, they have oil, they have gold. I mean, I know what you mean. Like, for the perhaps their population is not as big, and not everyone in their state gets to enjoy the, you know, the benefits of all those resources.
What I'm saying is that not all of the United States is going to be either economically or politically equal, even though there is federal law. You know, some states have different laws as well.
But that goes for any nation, any large country, or any country really. Like, not everything is going to be equal, obviously. But what I'm saying is, like, I don't think size determines whether an empire is gonna, or whether how powerful an empire is or not. No, not how powerful. Whether it's effective in ruling its people. I think if you have a lot of different types of people, obviously that's gonna
be, that's why,
you
know, I was,
there's a lot of interest, there's a lot of conflicting interests, right? Mm-hmm. And you're gonna have to deal with that, you're gonna have to manage it. But I don't think that it necessarily means that you won't be able to. It's just gonna take more effort. Like,
and no, well, what would you argue for someone who's trying to, like, from a specific territory is trying to assume independence from that territory? Like, how could you unite that particular, like, territory that's trying to become sovereign, even though the main country that's, like, you know, like, we can mention China and Taiwan. Taiwan wants to be independent. China's taken over Taiwan, and they're rejecting their calls for independence. In a way, like, how could, you know, there's still that division between Taiwan and China. They're not united. So how would
Because the Taiwanese government is a government exile from China. So the Republic of China is basically Taiwan, and then the People's Republic of China is what mainland China is, right?
Yeah.
So the government in Taiwan is an exile from China.
Exactly, at the same time, there, you know, like, also with the how do you pronounce their names?
The Uyghurs.
Yeah. You could also argue there that, you know, they're not united with the Chinese government. You know.
Yeah, they're not.
Exactly. Yeah,
China is doing every little tactic they can to make sure that they are able to control that territory, right?
Well, that's not unification at that point. That's more.
What is unification? Unification is, go ahead.
No, I'll go ahead. I want to hear your point.
I think unification is just, can you merge? Can you merge a territory and the people within your national political system, your economic system, social system?
So it doesn't have to be equal for those people per se. It just has to kind of get them under the same belt in a way.
Eventually, it could become equal. But yeah, the basic purpose is basically bring them under your umbrella. And then eventually you can, and in your systems, merge their systems with your systems. And eventually things may even out. I don't think that, you know, the way they're doing it is, you know, morally justifiable. But at the same time, like, you know, I'm not in their context, so I guess I'm not, you know, like, who am I to judge that, right? Like, that's
exactly. And I can't say too much because I'm not well, you know, informed about the whole situation going on in China and the different groups.
It's
there.
It's pretty bad, dude. It's pretty bad. I'll say that. It's pretty bad.
I'll definitely have to do my research on that. But for me, I know, like, I'm familiar with the Middle East because that's where I hail from. So I do understand where you're coming from with, like, okay, there are ways we can unify certain different ethnic religious groups. But at the same time, those groups are going to want sovereignty, and they're going to want to rule over what, you know, it's a matter of power.
They'll have their own interests. So it doesn't just have to be sovereignty. It could simply be like, hey, we want lower taxes on cotton. And someone can be like, nah, if you want higher taxes on cotton, right? Like, it could be something super petty. It could just be like, hey, we want access to this canal. Or someone can be like, we want to build a dam on this river so that, you know, we can get more electricity. And then another state, another nation, which is like just downstream, would be like, hey, if you do that, we would have less water for our irrigation, right? So you can have conflicts in anything.
Yeah, and like, I feel like that's more political than anything, because that's dealing with more political elements rather than sovereignty.
I mean, so sovereignty itself is a political element, right? It's a political movement, right? But
that doesn't, like, classify, like ethnicity and culture. It could also be just a political opinion. Like, you know, there's Republicans, Democrats, then you can have different ethnic groups and cultural groups mixed in within those two. It doesn't have to be like Democrats.
But yeah, right. there's a lot more demographics than just like, you know, the surface. There's like layers and layers to each demographic, right?
Yeah, that's why I think complexity in any situation is important, and also to keep in mind, like, where can we meet at the table and like to meet their demands to the fullest extent, and but also meet our demands with each one just agreeing on.
You'll never be able to meet anyone's demand to the fullest extent.
Well, no, not to the fullest extent, but like to a point that you guys can move forward. But then there's always going to be that, like that, you know, that power lock in which they're like, okay, well, I don't want to negotiate with you. And then the other party's like, okay, you don't want to do what we want to do, then we're not going to negotiate. I've seen this time and time again, especially with Palestine and Israel, you know, they negotiations start. They start to this, you know, like talk about land borders and stuff. And you know, the Palestinian government will mention something about Israeli settlements, and the Israeli like, you know, the Israeli government will be like, and you know, they'll be supportive of, like, you know, they'll support that aspect of what the Jewish settlers are trying to do in the West Bank. They're like, no, this is for security. This is for this and that. The Palestinians are like, okay, then I don't want to negotiate. So that's what I mean. Like, it's more political than just, you know, focus on the cultural, social aspect of it. But I think focusing on the social aspect of any situation is important by bringing the two peoples together, either through economic cooperation or just, you know, just through organizations to bring them together and to talk. I think then we can focus on the political side of it. But first of all, I think that focus on more of the social aspects, like how can we bring people together? How can we bring people on the same page? And not even just politicians, like everyday people. Bring them to the table. Let them cooperate. Let them start businesses together. Start doing business deals with each other. You know, and you know, build a society together. Build instead of destroy. That's where I'm coming from.
Sure, but I think if you can get the leaders, if you want a resolution or something, and the leaders are able to negotiate a resolution, I think the everyday people will follow.
But the leaders, that means that they're the representative of the people, and not all the people are going to agree that the leaders are the representative of them.
Yeah, so sure. Ultimately, the leader is whoever finds himself in that particular situation, you know, as a decision maker. Sometimes a leader can be accidental, right? Or a leader could be someone who just forced his way to that power, or probably does not represent the interests of everyone. And the leader, usually, generally speaking, will try to represent their own interests in any negotiation. Right, like if you're coming from Palestine, if you're coming from Israel, right, and if whatever negotiation somehow harm your personal interest, most likely you're gonna be like, nah, I'm not going for this. I want to be in a situation where I'm still in benefit, and you know, and yeah, if any everything else is an extra bonus.
And it like, you know, it's about winning, and then a day of power control. Like in the art of the war, that, you know, the main goal is to win the war and, you know, to assume power. But you also need to keep in mind the many other elements, such as, you know, morality. What were some of the other ones? I can't really.
I mean, yeah, it's ultimately about winning. You're right. And there's factors that go into it, right? And he talks about heaven, earth, I think, what is it, time, day, night, morality. What you call it, energy. There are a few different things talks about, but yeah. But overall, man, I think it's been a pretty good episode.
Yeah. I think we've
like well over the hour mark.
Yeah, definitely.
Who's your next guest? If you want to give the preview.
So we're bringing a guy that I know, and I've been acquaintances with him for quite a while. His name is called Ransom Fox. He's been working with I believe he's an aspiring politician. He, you know, has worked with campaigns for Andrew Yang and Harold Pion. You know, Andrew Yang was a presidential candidate, I believe, during the last election. And I think he's running for New York mayor or governor. I forgot what he was running for. But yeah, so we're going to be talking to him next time to see like some of his political beliefs, some of the things we believe we could change in the U.S. to make us more unified rather than divided, you know, some policy changes that he would like to see done. We're just going to talk a lot about politics. And also he has experience in the entrepreneurial field too. You know, he has his own podcast, and I feel like he'll be definitely an interesting person to talk to. So I'm really excited about that.
Sounds good.
Yeah. All right, Reesh, thank you for joining me, man. I really appreciate it. And yeah.